Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. We'll be checking in with Adam Boileau in just a moment to talk through all the week's security news, and then it'll be time for this week's sponsor interview. And this week's show is brought to you by Proofpoint, with this week's sponsor guest being Sherrod DeGrippo, Proofpoint's Senior Director of Threat Research. Last time we heard from Sherrod, she was actually on the show co-hosting the news with Adam and I, but today she is here with her Proofpoint hat on, and she'll be telling us about the emergence of some new mid-tier ransomware crews that are targeting people who speak Russian, which is kind of unusual. She will be explaining why. That is coming up after this week's news segment with Adam Boileau, which starts now. And Adam, we've got an absolutely fantastic story here from Shannon Vavra at Cyberscoop. She's got two. Our first two stories this week are both from Shannon Vavra. This is looking at the US government's efforts to safeguard COVID-19 vaccine research. This is actually very interesting.
Yeah, obviously we've talked a lot on the show about, you know, the risks to vaccine research and all of the other kind of COVID response aspects and the sort of the geopolitical back and forth. But what we haven't really seen a whole bunch about is the, you know, the specifics of what is being done to combat some of this. And this is a really great write-up of some of the work being done by Homeland Security and, you know, other agencies in the US government, you know, to go out and, you know, kind of defend forward. Like, that's the jargon they like these days, isn't it? You know, to actually go out and, you know, get into the various pharmaceutical companies and people that are doing work in the region and, you know, help them defend against, you know, threats that probably they can't realistically be expected to defend, you know, against themselves because of just the sheer importance of, you know, of the whole COVID situation, you know, geopolitically and health-wise and all the other things. So, yeah, this is talks about a program that's been stood up as part of Operation Warp Speed, which is kind of the overall program for producing a vaccine. And, yeah, it's just really interesting seeing, you know, some details.
Look, I think this is further evidence to Operation Warp Speed. Let's just give the Americans props, because if this were an Australian or New Zealand initiative, it would be called Operation Accelerated COVID-19 Vaccine Development. But no, for them, it's Operation Warp Speed. It's like why they have places named Death Valley and stuff like that as well. Much better at naming things, the Americans.
Than the North Island that we have in New Zealand.
The North Island and the South Island. I mean, what a convention. You know, stick with it. Why not? Look, I spoke to Chris Krebs about this as well, because one thing that was really interesting that shone through in this article is that by the looks of things, confidentiality isn't really the most important thing here, because vaccine research is kind of collaborative, but what you don't want is some foreign adversary ruining one of your trials by poisoning trial data or making it unavailable. So Chris actually had a chat to us about this, and here's what he had to say.
While the scientists and the doctors are doing their thing on the vaccine, we as security professionals have to be making sure that they can do their jobs on their networks with their equipment without being interrupted by some adversary, whether it's a nation state or a cyber criminal. And so when you think about the CIA triad, yes, we're concerned about confidentiality of the data, but this is already an open collaborative society in academia and research anyway. What we're concerned about is the integrity of the data and the availability of the data. Any sort of disruption will cost lives, and it's up to us, again, not just in government, but in public-private partnership to ensure that that doesn't happen and we can get this vaccine out as quickly as possible.
So I think that's really interesting. This is a security project that's really being designed to, you know, provide some resilience.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it does kind of make sense because, I mean, historically in medical, you know, in medical fields, confidentiality of patient data is one of the been, you know, the big focus for security work. And this is quite different, as he points out, right? I mean, fundamentally, virus research like this, vaccine research is going to be published, and yeah, all of the other aspects of it, which, you know, traditionally the medical profession hasn't been quite so focused on because they haven't really had malicious adversaries in, you know, the sense of, you know, wanting to alter drug trials, for example. So yeah, it's, you know, it's kind of a different thing than they're used to, and it's good to see that reality being reflected here because, I mean, there's so much security theater that we do as an industry, whereas here we have, you know, a very real problem. Clearly, everybody's interested. We need a real response, and it's good to see that that's actually what's happening.
Can you imagine some horrid adversary just trying to piss in the punch by actually manipulating trial data to make a vaccine look either ineffective or unsafe? Like,
I mean, I mean, you'd like to think that that's just kind of paranoia and far-fetched, but you know, the world is pretty weird these days. You know,
it is.
There's a lot of conflict. You know, a lot of conflict, and a lot of potential. You know, kind of conflicts. You know, that might come out of this whole thing. Like, it's kind of unfortunately real that we have to consider that. And yeah, it's good that they are actually, you know, getting down there and you know, providing real assistance.
And big thanks to the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency Director Chris Krebs for providing us with that comment. Brett and I realized that we'd been describing CISA as the Critical Infrastructure Security Agency in the newsletter for like 5 weeks before somebody noticed and wrote in. And, you know, despite our best efforts, they're not going to change it to our name. You know, those damn bureaucrats and the losers in Congress, unfortunately, will not come round to our way. So, yeah, apologies for that. For that error. Moving on. Oh, another one. This is the other one that Shannon had. Both of these stories appeared today, both on Cyberscoop. Really, really excellent work. This is a write-up of research that came out of Harvard's Belfer Center, looking really at which countries have their cybers together, right? And the old understanding that the USA is number one and then China is a distant second, well, not so distant anymore by the looks of things.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, pulling together information about what the capabilities of, you know, nation actors, are is a pretty difficult thing because it's necessarily kind of secret. And they went through the researchers went through this process of, you know, identifying, you know, what are the metrics by which we can judge the maturity of these programs, you know, in individual countries, how effective is their capability, what kind of things they can do, and, you know, built a bunch of metrics to try and actually put some structure around this and then be able to use, you know, open source information and other stuff they've got access to be able to kind of put things together and rate it. And yeah, it's quite an interesting set of work. I mean, you know, USA does come out number one still in their assessment, but, you know, the gap between US and China is very, very small. Plus, of course, there's a bunch of other actors on there that, you know, maybe people don't necessarily think about. You know, Switzerland, for example, is in the top 10.
Yeah,
there.
And those damn Swedes.
Yeah, there's a bunch of, you know, a bunch of people you wouldn't necessarily expect. But also, you know, it looks at the, you know, the maturity of their commercial sector. Obviously, you know, the Swiss have got a, you know, crypto IKEA.
Yeah, I mean, that's something to point out too, right? Like, these rankings just, they aren't just on offensive capability. It looks at sort of offense, defense, industry, the whole cyber shebang.
Yeah, and of course, you know, it makes sense, you know, just looking at China's set of capabilities, you know, in terms of their domestic, you know, commercial operations, right? I mean, they've got such a lot of expertise manufacturing hardware, building software, you know, lots of high-tech industry. You know, it makes sense that feeds into a general overall capability as well. But yeah, you know, there's so much just kind of finger in the air stuff, and it's nice to see, you know, in the analysis that we normally see. So it's nice to see, you know, researchers trying to take a structured approach. And, you know, the data kind of looks, you know, it kind of looks like what you expect, you know, when they lay it all out. You go, yeah, okay, that seems believable, which is always a good sniff test. You know, this kind of wonkery can sometimes be a bit kind of, what, you know, whereas this actually looks pretty in line with, you know, you see Singapore, you see Vietnam, you see North Koreans, it, you know, kind of lines up.
Yeah, it does. And I don't know what this means for our old concepts around asymmetry when you're really looking at the most sort of powerful countries still being the most powerful in this ranking, right? Like, wasn't this supposed to be all about asymmetry? Is Iran's program evidence of the cybers being asymmetric? I don't know anymore.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the world's kind of changed. It's a little, you know, it's a much more complicated and nuanced set of things. And especially when we're seeing these capabilities exercised in a more, you know, holistic geopolitical way. Like, it's not just, you know, we're using hacking in isolation. Like, we're seeing these things done, you know, to further national goals and in the context of, you know, the trade stuff, for example, between China and the US. Like, these things are used as chess pieces in larger games, which is, you know, that changes the traditional kind of technical asymmetry to, you know, a much more balanced geopolitical sort of thing.
Now, the capitalist dogs at ASPI, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs' favourite think tank, ASPI, the lapdogs of the American defence sector, I think they like to call them, they've actually put out a very interesting report looking at TikTok and WeChat censorship. And to be honest, I'm still sort of formulating my view on all of this. I mean, what they found is that, really, when you drill into it, what they've found is that if you don't want your content being shadow banned on like TikTok, make it as apolitical as possible.
Yeah, which I guess is not really a surprise. And one of the things that struck me about this is that, you know, we have so little visibility into the inner workings of social network and the algorithms that all of the various operators use to rank their content, that, yeah, it's not really surprising that middle of the road content does well. And, you know, the fact that this, in the case of TikTok, right, that there is kind of language specific sets of rules that the algorithms behave differently in different territories and different languages.
Yeah, so if that's the thing, right? Like, so if you use the hashtag gay in Russian, like your stuff sinks like a stone through the rankings sort of thing, right?
Yeah, and that's an interesting kind of difference, right? Because you naturally think of it in country boundaries. But yeah, from the algorithm's point of view, I guess, you know, you've got one for processing English language stuff, you've got one for processing Russian, whatever else, you know, and it's kind of natural that that lumps together with a bunch of then spillover, you know, say Hong Kong, where there's lots of English spoken as well. You can imagine it behaving differently there than perhaps the authorities would expect. So there's just some interesting nuance there. But yeah, it's... You know, I do wonder how well all of the other social media operators would stand up to the same sort of scrutiny.
It's going to look different. I mean, this is why I'm still sort of working out what I think this means. Obviously, I think it's terrible that they're censoring LGBTQ issues, right? Like, that's, you know, that's not great. On the flip side of that, though, imagine how nice Facebook would be if it was. You ever been to those houses and there's a little sign on the door that says "No politics, no religion"? You know, to sort of discourage canvases. Wouldn't that be nice if it did just go back to videos of Aunt Sally tap dancing?
Well, I mean, I guess that would be a nice corner of the internet, but, you know.
I guess what I'm saying is I just don't know how insidious this is, given that they seem to be just aiming for their platform to be completely apolitical rather than tilted one way or the other. And look, you know, before you yell at me, please realize that I have not really had a chance to digest this report yet.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess TikTok is trying to aim for, you know, a not so edgy, not so political kind of, you know, use case. Like, it's meant to be, you know, people dancing and music and stuff, right? But yeah, all of these platforms turn into politics and, you know, seeing it.
And that's worked out so great, hasn't it, on Facebook?
But I know it's just kind of rude seeing it laid out like this, right? I mean, it's one thing to kind of know that things are being shaped, but when it's just, you know, when there's a study right in front of you that says these specific issues, you know, agendas about sexuality are being pushed, you know, by a corporate entity. Like, it's just like, that's kind of, yeah, it's icky and dystopian and gross.
It's icky. Yeah, no, I'm with you. Like, that one, as far as I'm concerned, that one is like completely over the line as well, because it's not even a matter of politics. It's a matter of human rights, right? But Fergus Ryan worked on this report and he actually gave us some of his time to discuss it. Here's what he had to say.
We really wanted to have a look at both TikTok and WeChat and just try and get a clear understanding of how much censorship, if any, is taking place on both of those apps, and also the extent to which users of those apps are being surveilled. So there were a lot of different inputs into the paper. We did a lot of Chinese language research, looking at the websites of both companies, the statements made by senior executives at both Tencent, which owns and operates WeChat, and ByteDance, which owns and operates TikTok. In addition to that, we had some very talented technical colleagues helping us to sort of poke around both of the apps to try and get a sense of what's happening under the hoods of both the apps. Ultimately, with TikTok, we figured out that certain hashtags, for example, hashtag gay in Russian, is categorized in the same way on TikTok as words like ISIS or Nazi or KKK or hashtag cocaine. And that gave us a good insight into how TikTok is suppressing certain types of content on the platform, based on languages, I'd add, not necessarily based on regions or countries.
So yeah, look, it's interesting work and I'm glad Aspie's done it, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's an important insight because, you know, so few people do get to understand how the algorithms that, you know, shape how we communicate about all these, you know, important issues, as well as the, you know, recreational stuff. You know, we have so little visibility of that, and it's good to kind of claw some of it back.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I'm sure I'm going to have like more cogent thoughts on this at some point, but at the moment I'm still just getting my head around a social media platform that is actually striving to not have people argue on it. Like it's such a it's such a weird concept, right?
Argument drives engagement.
Yes, that old chestnut. Now, look, staying with mobile apps, and an app in Belarus has been removed from the Android Play Store because it looks like it may have been put there by the Belarusian government in order to track protesters and identify protesters and stuff. This is bad.
This seems really, really scummy and, you know, kind of in line with what you're expecting given the news coming out of Belarus. So this was an app called Next Alive, which was masquerading or pretending to be the mobile app of, an independent Belarusian news agency that's been pretty active and, is used by people who are involved in protesting in the situation in Belarus. So, of course, yeah, the app masqueraded as that, and then harvested a bunch of information, reported the location, telemetered that all back to some IP address in Russia that was previously seen hosting a domain that looked kind of dodgy as well. Obviously, the lines of intent point towards the Belarusian government, but there's no direct technical attribution that anyone's talked about.
Could also be the Russian government just trying to help out their mate, you know.
I mean, the Russians do like to get all up in all the business of the ex-Soviet republic, so yeah, that could totally make sense as well. But yeah, so the app was quite widely downloaded, it appeared, and then a local researcher there pulled it apart, talked to the legitimate publication, who then publicized that through their various channels and encouraged people to remove the app and also to report it to Google, give it bad reviews. It's now been pulled from the app store, but it was there for a while. Like I think it was a few weeks.
So
that's not great.
Julian Assange is back in court in the UK as part of extradition proceedings. His lawyers are now arguing that he should not be sent to the United States to face charges because that would make him sad.
Which, I mean, to be fair, probably would make him sad. But yeah, the arguments are kind of starting to be laid out. The whole process is, of course, going to take a while. But yeah, the defense has fielded a bunch of, testimony from medical professionals who've talked to Julian and say that, he is a, mental health would be a risk, potentially a suicide risk, if he were to be extradited. And of course, there's some precedent in extradition cases from the UK. I'm thinking of Gary McKinnon and Laurie Love, for example, who both kind of tried to avoid the extradition on grounds of, the mental health aspects, which, are legitimate. I don't know whether they're legitimate in this case. I'm sure Julian would be sad. But yeah, we'll see, I guess, where this goes.
But he doesn't strike me as the suicide type, I guess, is what I'm getting at, right?
Well, I mean, he's been locked up for a long time, right?
He's been locked up for 15 months. He was in the closet of his own choosing. Don't forget that. Okay. Look, the amount of mail we get every time we talk about this. God, since I sent over the news list to you, there has been a development, which is he got yelled at by a judge because he was sort of interjecting as various people were talking, and the judge said, look, we can do this without you, not that we want to, but you best pipe down, and he did for the remainder of the proceedings. But it's all going through the thing. Apparently he's got Asperger's and he'll kill himself if he, and it's all political persecution and etc. Moving on, a Chilean bank, the state-owned bank in Chile, Banco Estado, has their branches are all closed except for a couple because of a ransomware attack. It looks like mostly it's surviving. The ATM network and online is mostly surviving, but they've had to close a bunch of branches, according to this piece by Catalin Kimpanu.
Yeah, reports say that initially entry was through some kind of phishing, and then they got hit by the Revil gang and they locked up and ransomed nearly all of the internal server systems and desktops. They do say that reports do say that some of the production systems, online banking, ATMs were segregated to an extent. That seems like a having reviewed those sorts of controls at banks, I'm sure that the Revil crew are capable of jumping that boundary if they needed to. But hey, maybe they've done enough and they got whatever money they got out of the bank. We haven't seen a report that they've paid out. One data point is that the Revil crew do steal data and release it if you don't pay, and the bank hasn't yet showed up on there like we're going to leak your data site. So maybe some money changed hands, I don't know. But I mean, this is just for a bank that size, right? This is what, the third largest bank in Chile. That's pretty bad. And it could happen to your bank too, dear listeners.
Well, that's kind of why it's in the news, right? Is because when you're talking about banks with hundreds of branches, this bank has a security budget and this has happened anyway.
Well, yeah, right? I mean, this stuff's hard to get right, but the consequences of not getting it right are, I mean, can you imagine, like, all your branches closed, you know, for days and days, all your customers freaking out. It's just not a place you want to be. And I mean, they had a rough time, like the banking sector in Chile has definitely had a rough time. We've seen, you know, attacks against some of the other banks, denial of service and all sorts of things. I'm so glad I'm not involved in the, you know, like hourly crisis con calls that are going on at the moment there.
Yeah, yeah. Now, last week, Alex and I discussed the DDoS attack against the New Zealand Stock Exchange. What's the latest with that, by the way? Has that resolved yet?
So we saw a few more rounds of DDoS, and there was a couple of other kind of, little flurries of DDoS against a few other, you know, a couple of media companies, a few other organizations here. But by and large, it's been quiet since then. Obviously, you know, there's still a bit of, interest in the local media. There's a bunch of work going on, government agencies and various people trying to make sure that all of their ducks
trying
in a row.
Trying to not host their domain name servers on the same network as their content
servers.
Well,
I mean, you know, in the end, New Zealand network is not bad, but there's a lot of shared points of of that kind of infrastructure, so there's, you know, plenty of scope for collateral damage, but yeah, it does seem like the same crew, or at least a crew inspired by the same crew, has been doing this kind of thing in a number of places around the world.
Yeah, that's why I bring it up, right? It looks like DDoS based extortion is going through a bit of a renaissance at the moment,
which is weird because no one seems to be paying, right? And there's pretty limited evidence that anyone is paying, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to pay. I mean, compared to, you know, more traditional sorts of ransomware, like paying someone to not do something is quite different than paying them to undo a thing that they already did. I don't know how much money they're making. It's weird that it's made a comeback.
It kind of is, right? Because we do now live in the age of mega CDNs, right? Like, it's pretty much attacks like these, normally 9 times out of 10, that's going to be your CDN's problem, not yours.
Yeah, and I mean, we're seeing, you know, these are not necessarily small attacks. I mean, this crew has been seen throwing, you know, a couple of hundred gigabit around the place, right? Which is not a small amount of traffic.
No, I think it peaked at around 300 gig per second, which is, you know, like, yeah. Now it's just like, whatever. Akamai will sync it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, all of the CDNs are perfectly capable of that kind of thing. And, you know, we're just much more used to volumetric DDoS because of the kind of consolidation of the CDN world and the experience of the kind of late 2000s when DDoS was kind of more of a dangerous thing. So, yeah, I'm surprised. And, you know, I know volumetric DDoS is kind of easy in the sense that, you know, you can reflect some packets and get on with your life. It's not too complicated. You can just kind of point it and see what happens. You know, there's so much other scope for other sorts of denial of service that would be more effective as kind of blackmail vectors.
I think one of the biggest things that's changed over the last 10 years is mitigating this stuff used to be really, really expensive. And now it's just not. Now it's just sort of comes with the service.
Now you can get it for free, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so there we go. I mean, hey, listeners, if you've heard of anyone paying, let us know. But as best we can tell, it hasn't really happened yet. Now, I don't know if you remember this, Adam, but some time ago we spoke about this hack at Service New South Wales here in Australia, right, where there was this big round of coverage, of press coverage, saying that 47 mailboxes at Service New South Wales, and they handle stuff like our, you know, what Americans would call their DMV, right? It's where you go to get your driver's license, and it's actually pretty cool. In New South Wales, all state government services are kind of integrated into Service New South Wales. You go to the door, and there's usually someone there to greet you, to ask like what you're there for that day. It's actually quite nice. It's surprising having state government services that are as nice. So don't attack Service New South Wales, people. But they did this big announcement and a big song and dance about 47 mailboxes getting popped. And at the time we were like, geez, I wonder what the interesting thing is here, because, you know, people are taking it very seriously considering it seems like a very limited attack. But turns out you can do a fair bit with 47 mailboxes, Adam.
Yeah, especially when those mailboxes handle like scanned documents and stuff coming and going. Clearly there was a bunch of data accessible from there, because reports seem to suggest there was something like, 700 gig worth of data exfilled? Something crazy like that?
Yeah, 3.8 million documents. And I think they've identified 186,000 people who've been impacted, and they're all going to get, and this is cool, they're all going to get contacted by registered post to prevent the attackers being able to use this as a sort of phishing opportunity. I think that's pretty good. That strikes me as being pretty good practice. No word really on who was behind this. maybe just normal criminals?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to say. I mean, you know, I'm sure if there was examples of the data being used for identity theft or unsold or whatever else, that, you know, we would have kind of seen some hint of that. But yeah, we don't really know. And obviously, I mean, the nature of the information that they handle is pretty sensitive and would be pretty good for criminal things. But yeah, we just kind of don't really know the who. We got a little bit more idea of the what now. But yeah, the who and the why, still not really clear.
Yeah, 47 mailboxes, 700 gig. That's like, yikes.
Yeah, that's a lot of IMAP.
Oh, we've got a story here from Wired looking at so-called geofence warrants and why they're sort of on the nose among US judges. This is an interesting read.
Yeah, so I mean, this talks about these warrants where the police can go to, you know, a service provider like Google and say, we would like records for any of your users that within a particular geographic range at a particular point in time. And that, you know, you could imagine that being the sort of thing that would be really interesting to police forces. You know, you're investigating a robbery or something that happened in a particular place. If you can get data from, you know, a phone company or Google or whoever else, to get a list of, you know, here's 300 phones that were in that area in the hour, then you've got a whole bunch of leads to go and investigate. And you can, you know, you could just absolutely see the value of this. But yeah, we've seen a ruling here from a federal judge in Chicago, basically saying that this type of warrant is an unreasonable search because of the potential for kind of, you know, a whole bunch of people to be involved and therefore subject to unreasonable search, I think is whatever the US rules say. And yeah, I mean, you can see the motivations for doing it. Obviously, the companies in question have a lot of the data and are able to answer these questions. I think Google said that they've seen, you know, a real uptick in this particular sort of query. But yeah, clearly as a society, you know, we're going to have to figure out, you know, where the bounds of this are, because clearly it's useful, right? This kind of metadata analysis.
Well, it's sort of making that old trope about how now you've got a tracking device in your pocket all the time. It's making that true, right?
Yeah, absolutely, right? It is making it a lot more true when you can go out and get that data for whatever reason. And of course, there's both the combination of, you know, lawful access through a warrant like this mechanism, and then the kind of commercialization of similar data sets that then get used for both, you know, law enforcement and other purposes as well.
Which,
and kind of figuring out.
Which brings us to our next story, actually, which is one by Joe Cox. He's really picked this up almost as a beat over at Vice Motherboard. And he has spoken about this firm called, he's done a story about this firm called Hyas, H-Y-A-S, which is a private company that does exactly that. And look, you know, he quotes a couple of people anonymously in this story saying that they had demos of this stuff and they, you know, they found it super creepy. We know a couple of people who had exactly the same experience. They demoed it and they're like, this is like a private SIGINT database, right? Like, this is super powerful.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, there's a reason SIGINT agencies collect this kind of data because it is really useful.
But I think there are actually protections preventing SIGINT agencies from collecting this much data. Do you know what I mean? I mean? And, you know, you and I would have both had that conversation with someone in SIGINT who said, if we could just do a tenth of what Google does, right? Like, you heard that from them before? Because I have.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. I mean, the amount of paperwork they have to go through, the amount of checks and balances to make having that kind of data a little less creepy. Yeah, just having this available.
But now you can just bust out your credit card and buy it from these guys, right?
Yeah, which, I mean, it's creepy and weird, and obviously we will have to try and figure out how this all actually happens, but yeah, it's, I don't know, you know, there's so much data out there, and it makes sense that people are going to pull it together and use it and then repackage it and sell it and do all sorts of creepy stuff, and yeah, it's, I don't know, it's hard when you actually see it, though, you know?
Yeah, and look, I mean, I came up, like, in talking to people I know about this, like, another one came up, which is Team Coomery. They have some NetFlow sets which have left people I know feeling a little bit uncomfortable, right? Like, the extent of their NetFlow collection is pretty extreme.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly, you know, there's a real continuum between, you know, the kind of SIGINT scary amounts of data and, you know, complete privacy and anonymity, and it's weird how far, how much of that capability that you would have traditionally expected to only be a thing SIGINT agencies can do has trickled down into things private sector can do, you know, things individual citizens can do, and things that, you know, kind of nominally non-commercial groups like Dinkumru and Shadow Server and all of the other, you know, sort of affiliated groups, you know, can manage essentially on their own, you know, which it's pretty wild.
It's a funny old world, as they say. Cyber in space.
There's been a lot of cyber in space lately, I was thinking, reading this.
I mean, I included this because I know you, man. You love cyber in space.
I do love cyber in space. This is a story about the White House publishing the new Space Policy Directive 5, which talks about the requirements for cybersecurity controls for orbiting platforms and ground control systems and all that kind of thing. The question, and it all seems pretty sensible. You know, it's exactly what you'd expect. Maybe you should encrypt your command and control for a satellite. Maybe you should be able to update the software on your satellite. Although, to be honest, like having hard-coded software that you can't update also seems like a good idea. I don't know. It's got the things that you would expect. But the question I have is, what actually got owned that prompted all of this? Because there's just been such a flurry, you know, with the DEFCON space stuff going on and this and... You know,
well, I just would have thought the gradual progression of foreign adversaries into all manner of control networks would be enough to make doing this sort of thing prudent. You know, I don't think you necessarily need a major incident to prompt this, given everything else that's happening.
I mean, I don't know. I just, you know, the change around here tends to happen in a knee-jerk fashion, or in the industry tends to happen in a knee-jerk fashion as a result of, you know, LulzSec or ransomware or COVID-19. You know, the, you know, real big things happening push people to actually make stuff. Otherwise, everything gets bogged down in committees forever. And this just feels like maybe there was actually a really juicy incident somewhere that we don't know about.
You reckon someone popped calc.exe on, you know, Sputnik 5 or something?
I mean, maybe, right? Anyway, I'm sure one of our listeners knows and, you know, would love to tell us about it.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure they would. Now, you remember the startup Votes, VOATZ? They are the e-voting blockchain company who love to attack no researchers. Now, this one, I think this is, Jeff Stone wrote this up for Cyberscoop. It's been all over Twitter as well. Votes, oh, they're just such assholes, right? Like, you know, there's this Supreme Court case coming up that will have big ramifications for the way the CFAA is interpreted, right? And so a lot of people are filing, you know, amicus briefs and whatnot, you know, sort of urging the Supreme Court to go this way or go that way. Votes put in an amicus brief basically saying, you know, you shouldn't let anyone probe anything for vulnerabilities without permission. You should, like, absolutely go hardline. Et cetera, et cetera. And they cited how, oh, you know, we worked with HackerOne, so, you know, clearly anyone going outside that process is a criminal, and HackerOne are like, lol, you know, we had nothing to do with this and we disagree with everything they've said.
And you're literally the only company we've ever fired.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, what are your thoughts on this?
I mean, they really do not seem like the sort of people you want involved in your democratic process. You know, the idea that there should not be public oversight and public visibility and the ability for you know, individual citizens to investigate how these things work in their name is just ludicrous. And I hope they die in a fire. I mean, wow. In a corporate fire, I guess.
A metaphorical fire.
A metaphorical corporate fire as opposed to a literal, yes, you know, burning, screaming death fire.
Oh, dear. Oh, look, more court action. And, man, I'm losing track, right? Because, you know, there was the NSA call metadata collection program. This is where under Section 215 of the Patriot Act, the NSA essentially had rolling demand letters which were forcing US telcos to hand over call records to the NSA to ingest into a giant central database. Now, this was one of the only things that Edward Snowden, you know, talked about dropped docs on that was actually, you know, super dodgy. Courts have found this program, which has since been discontinued, by the way. They've moved to much more of a sort of compulsory metadata retention scheme in the United States, sort of similar to what we have here in other places, here in Australia and other places. But this program has been ruled illegal and legal and illegal and legal. We've got another ruling here saying that it was illegal. So there we go. It's illegal again.
And not only illegal, but worthless. Apparently, it actually netted essentially one example of a person that they were actually interested in who was actually doing a bad thing. So, yeah, it seems like quite a lot of data to collect and grind for just one case. And, you know, compared to at the time, the NSA saying, hey, this was really important at preventing all sorts of terrorist attacks and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, one.
Yes. And illegal. It'll probably be legal again in a couple of weeks, even though it's it's no longer running. But there you go. And, of course, you know, Snowden is turning this into his big vindication moment. And of course, he should get a pardon. You know what's really funny is we spoke about the politics of that pardon. Since then, Rand Paul has come out and he's doing the whole deep state. Yeah, this is, he revealed the deep state and the deep state was spying on Trump, so Edward Snowden should get a pardon. So it was exactly right. And he is the one pulling the strings on this, right? Because Rand Paul has always wanted to get Snowden off the hook, and he knows how to manipulate Donald Trump, right? So, and he has his ear, right? So that's my feeling for what's going on now, is Rand Paul saying, yeah, man, strike back at the deep state by pardoning this guy. That's what it's about.
Anyway. I mean, to be fair, the deep state will probably be kind of pissed.
By the deep state, you mean our audience.
Yeah, yes, I mean, all of our audience, you know, slave away for the goodness of Uncle Sam in many, many cubicles, you know.
Ah, Project Zero 2.0.
Yes, Facebook has publicized some details of its responsible vulnerability disclosure policy, you know, outlining the mechanism by which they'll interact with external parties, open source projects and things. You know, Facebook finds a lot of bugs in the process of reviewing their own internal stuff. Just, you know, their supply chain is just that big. So, yeah, they've come up with a policy that, yeah, looks pretty similar to what you'd expect, you know, kind of 90-day full disclosure, a bunch of carve-outs for, you know, if it's necessary, if something's being exploited in the wild, you know, if an open source project is not responding to reports of security flaws and things. So, yeah, kind of what you'd expect, and good to see Facebook putting this in process. You know, there is a lot of good security work that comes out of Facebook just by virtue of, you know, all the problems they got to solve. So, yeah.
Oh, man, what a bug. What a bug. Tell us about this. And this is so cool because it's actually similar to that, like, to the Slack / Electron bug that I spoke about with Alex last week. You know, this is another one of those cross-site scripting to RCE bugs, but this time in Jabber, and it's so bad.
Yeah, Cisco's having a pretty bad day with this one, I think. Some researchers from a company called Watchcom gave Cisco a bit of a bad day looking into a number of bugs in the Cisco Jabber client, which is based on the embedded Chromium framework, which basically, yeah, standalone browser that you can run these kinds of apps on people's desktops natively. And, you know, much like we've seen with Electron, you know, other apps that use Electron that you talked about, traditional web bugs all of a sudden are a lot more potent, you know, when you're running them outside of a browser sandbox. Like, there's a reason it took, you know, all of the people that work on the Chrome sandbox, you know, so long to make that robust, because it's really hard. And turning off those defenses and using it safely is just beyond the expertise of your average workaday developer. And quite rightly so, right? This is a hard thing to do.
Well, you can't expect them to write a really good web application and package it up in one of these things and also know exactly about, like, all of the security stuff that has to happen on the host as well and how those two things interact. Like, that's just forget it.
That's, I mean, it's real niche specialist stuff. And, you know, there's a reason why it's safe to run all of the things that we do in a browser by and large, because of the amount of work and effort that has gone into compartmentalizing all those features and sandboxing it and reviewing, you know, all of the interfaces between the components that implement that isolation. Anyway, moral of the story is you can't really expect, you know, Joe developer down at Cisco to be able to do a good job of that. And these bugs are just testament to that. Like, send a message via Jabber, get code exec on the host. And there's a number of, like, there's like three or four bugs that they're talking about, the researchers are talking about here. And it's just, it's so bad. And people expose this stuff externally.
It is so bad. And you can worm it, right? And so the only prerequisite here is that you have to have access to the XMPP domain, which ain't going to be that hard, right? And the nice thing is, like, if it's an internal XMPP domain, you know, you can worm this and it's not going to escape and take over the planet, but you will be able to take over a bank, for example, or any organization, and might be useful for certain types of campaigns, Adam.
Well, yeah, exactly right. If I was a ransomware operator, I would be looking at this bug going, hell yeah. Like, yep, this is the good one. Like, this kind of app, you know, like rich desktop applications that are built on top of a browser engine, you can leverage everything you know about web apps, and you get the bonus of probably code exec as a result of the, you know, lack of sandboxing or effective sandboxing. And everyone runs it. And, you know, a lot of these things are, you know, communications apps, you know, like Jabber, that do get exposed externally so that you can interact with other parties. Like, it's got all of the ingredients that the, like, Citrix remote access bugs had, that the, you know, Pulse VPN and then the other remote access security gateway products that we've seen used to such effect. This has just got all of those pieces in it, this and this type of bug, you know, because there will be similar sorts of bugs in other comms and collaboration products like this. So yeah, like, this is, you know, this will be the next big one, I think, in terms of vector, because it's just, it's got everything you need.
Yeah, I think one of them has, yeah, CVE-2023-495 has a 9.9 CVSS, which is like, you know,
like that point one seems a bit rude.
That point one is probably just because you need to get to the XMPP domain first, right? Like if I had to guess.
You have to be able to spell XMPP.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, I curmudgeonly said, you know, don't run Electron apps. I really meant don't run apps, really, when you can avoid it. Like if you can do it in a browser, do it in a browser.
Do it in a browser.
I mean, do you agree with me, man? Because I kind of got shouted down as like being one of those security curmudgeons giving impractical advice. But like,
oh, hell no. Yeah, like if you want to run Slack, run it in a browser. You want to run Jabber, run it in a browser. You want to run Microsoft Teams, run it in a browser. Like that's what the browser is for. Like it's got the
love of all that is good,
15 years
run it in
of
a
engineering.
Yeah, that's right.
To try and make it safe to run arbitrary code on your machine. Like the JVM didn't do it for Java. The browser is the best you got. Use it, please, for the love of God.
Yes, that's we are as one on this one.
We are.
But I like how, you know, you and I, we kind of like to have it both ways as well, because we also give shit to Google for adding functionality to Chrome.
Well, I mean, Chrome has gotten, you know, bloated and over-featured and but...
At least it's got competent people behind it and, you know, the architecture's right, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they get a lot of things right. I mean, it's not Internet Explorer 6, right? So that's good.
Yeah.
by that metric, good.
Yeah, that's right. We got a bit of a skateboarding dog here. Adam, not technically a security story, but it's too funny not to mention. A man from South Carolina, Terry Sean Patrill, 48, of Myrtle Beach. He worked as the IT security director for Horry County in South Carolina. He was ordering a whole bunch of Cisco switches, you know, and he'd say, don't worry, I'll install them, guys. The new switches would turn up. He'd just take them home and sell them on eBay. So he's going to prison for 2 years. I mean, that's, you got to love the simplicity of the scam.
Yeah, I mean, it's just super straightforward. And clearly the old switches worked fine, which is, you know, testament, I guess, to the fact that maybe you don't need a brand new switch. But yeah, the audacity of it, right? It's just, you know, I mean, other than getting caught, it's a flawless plan.
There you go. Between April 25 and August 5 this year, Warner Music was getting mage carded and didn't notice. So nice one, Warner Music.
Yoish, yeah. Yeah, that's not ideal. You know, mage card crews have been really effective and you hope that people would notice it, but I guess not if they've been doing it for a while.
SonicWall is this week's vendor of fail. This is bad.
Oh, geez. Yeah. They have some kind of cloud management thing for SonicWall firewalls. And it turned out that if you could get access to that, i.e. buy a SonicWall product, then you could manage other people's firewalls through their cloud management service. And, you know, remote access.
Yeah. With apologies to Paul Lanzi, who gets very upset when we use the sad trombone noise. But I'm sure he would agree in this case, it is justified.
I mean... what can you even say, right? I mean, security vendors doing this kind of garbage, this ought to be existential for you know, a security product vendor, but it's not going to be.
I'm pretty sure it was a, you know, SonicWall not checking their firmware updates that got, was it Hacking Team owned? I'm pretty sure it was SonicWall. One of the Phineas Fisher hacks was definitely, they basically just reflashed the SonicWall with a whole bunch of like hacker tools and used it as like their staging point to rip the shit out of them. It was pretty bad.
That's a good time. Yeah, well, I mean, moral of the story is just don't trust SonicWall to be your security partner. But
maybe that's it.
Come on, really.
I think we just gave a few marketing people heart attacks, by the way. So happy days.
Well, don't... get your customers owned then. Jeez, is that hard?
Sounds like sensible advice. Now, before we go, Adam, we've got to say congratulations to you, because Insomnia Security, the company that you not only work for but were a shareholder in, has been acquired.
Yeah, after 13 years, of which I think I've been here about 12, we've sold up the company. You know, Insomnia is a, you know, little security consultancy firm, and we've been acquired by CyberCX.
And now we have to stop teasing them about their name.
I guess we do.
And we should point out too that nothing on Risky Biz is going to change as a result of this acquisition.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I've been doing Risky Biz almost as long as I've been at Insomnia. So, nothing's going to change here. You know, I'm going to keep on coming on the show, talking about things. There's should be no change at all to the poor Risky Biz listeners.
Fantastic. That's what we like to hear. Adam, thank you so much for joining us this week to talk through the news. And we'll do it all again next week. Business as usual.
Thanks very much, Pat. Talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Big thanks to him for that. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Sherrod DeGrippo of Proofpoint. Sherrod works on the threaty threat research stuff over there at Proofpoint, and she's noticed a couple of new trends, the emergence of some new mid-tier ransomware players and some campaigns increasingly targeting people who speak Russian. Here's Sherrod.
It seems like we're seeing ransomware that is smaller in volume and a little more bespoke, possibly. And also, a trend that I'm seeing in ransomware is that the ransomware actors are leveraging their creativity for comedy.
In what way?
So Avedon is a great example. They have this sort of heavy metal 80s looking logo. So the ransomware trend is to have like a logo and graphics and characters. So Avedon, the second A is a wizard hat, and it's got this 80s metal look to it. And then their ransom payment screen has cartoon characters of Harry Potter. It has Dumbledore, Sirius Black, who's my favorite character, and Hagrid.
It's funny, I'm just reminded of a conversation I actually had with one of your colleagues recently where they say there's some pretty funny text popping up in some of the ransomware these days. I think one of them, when they pulled it apart, they found a string in there that said, please hire me as a security researcher.
That was a campaign that we saw, and that's for a ransomware that you and I were talking about before, which is this Decrypt Russian ransomware. It's the one that says, please hire me as a security researcher. Yeah.
And there was another one that says that said, like, in Turkish, we are from Thailand or something like that. Or what was that one?
I didn't see that one. But Nemty, which is a ransomware, uses Rick and Morty, which is a cartoon character as well, on their landing pages. So, you know, they're using cartoon characters and pop culture and just really making a whole theme. It's branded.
They're trying to make your job a little more pleasant, I'm guessing, which is, you know, that's very considerate of them.
They're definitely doing it for me. Absolutely. Yeah.
There you go. Now, you did just mention a Russian, a new strain of Russian ransomware. Tell us why that's unusual.
So we don't usually see ransomware in Russian language. I think probably a lot of the listeners know that Russia is a crimeware wonderland in terms of crimeware actors coming out of that region. But we don't see a lot of ransomware that's actually in Russian. So the ransom note and the explanation that you've gotten ransomware is in Russian. And when I looked through the campaigns over the past 2 or 3 weeks, the majority of the targets to receive that ransomware called Decrypt. So it's DECR1PT, a little bit of leet speak in the spelling. Everybody that received it that I looked at was based in Russia. The targets were Russian associates in some way. So they're all working for large enterprise based in Europe, United States, North and South America, but they have some Russian connection either because they work in a Russian city or they have a Russian background.
Now, it is unusual, isn't it, to see, I mean, the philosophy, the understanding is that Russian cyber criminals don't shit where they eat, right? I mean, that's kind of what
it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
And the reasoning behind that has typically been that the law enforcement in Eastern Europe and Russian country, in Eastern European countries and Russia will just sort of let it slide under the radar and not really go after.
Not our problem, victims elsewhere. I think it's the same. Like, I think if you're an American crook, it probably makes sense to target outside of the United States. I don't think this is just a Russian thing. I think generally speaking, targeting outside your home jurisdiction is just sensible.
I think that's probably true. And we've seen that it's kind of just a general profession in Eastern Europe and Russian countries, the same way for Morocco, you know, Nigeria, West African countries, it's kind of seen as a legitimate job. And, you know, we've looked at some of the indictments for gangs like Fin7. I mean, they're using Jira. They're using those typical work productivity applications. They're following, you know, operational workflow the same way software developers do.
I don't know if you've ever watched the Fargo TV series, which if any of the listeners haven't seen it, it is excellent. It's really, really quite good. In one of the seasons, there's a criminal who winds up, you know, he's out there on the street. He's doing violence. He's doing like real crime. And the whole idea is he wants to move up in this organized criminal enterprise. And at the end of the series, spoiler alert, everyone, skip forward 30 seconds if you don't want to hear my spoiler.
Spoiler.
You know, he winds up essentially working in a cubicle for this criminal organization, which is not really what the guy, you know, he wanted to be a badass, and he winds up in a cubicle. And it seems like these crews, like, that's pretty much your life, right? You're stuck dealing with JIRA tickets in a cubicle somewhere.
Literally JIRA tickets. It was in one of the FIN7 indictments that came out in December.
Yeah, because they indicted the admin, didn't they, who was like running the ticketing infrastructure and whatnot.
Yeah, and they did some really good victim identities in there. They named a lot of the victims. So some of the breaches were able to be connected into that indictment, which was pretty cool.
So,
yeah,
so hang on. What do we know about this, you know, Russian malware? I mean, is it possible that the attackers are located in a, you know, in a Russian speaking country that is not Russia?
I think that's totally possible. Yeah, we see, and also the targets that we're seeing are typically working at Western companies that typically are located in Russia as well. So you might work for a company that's headquartered in the United States, but you might be assigned to work in Moscow.
So that's what the targeting looks like. It's actually Russian employees of global companies who are located physically in Russia.
Correct.
And do you know anything about these attackers? I mean, because I'd imagine you do a little bit of, you know, OSINTing and whatnot. Have you figured much out?
So this is an actor that we haven't put attribution on. Ransomware attribution is really hard because ransomware can be passed around very easily and doesn't necessarily require common infrastructure. So we haven't done a lot on the actor yet, but it does look like that targeting is consistent across every campaign that we've seen for this particular ransomware.
Which would suggest one crew.
Which would suggest potentially one crew. We'd like to see some more campaigns to figure that out, but yeah, it seems like it's potentially one actor.
Okay, so that's one group that you're talking about doing this bespoke stuff. Like, how much of a trend is this? Is this just something that's sort of bubbled up in some of your telemetry, or is this setting in?
So over the past month or so, we've seen 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We've seen 6 different new ransomware types come onto the scene in not necessarily large volume. So when I would say medium or small volume, I would say 500 to 1,000 messages in a day. So 1,000 messages in a campaign is probably medium for us. Large would be 1 million or more. And they're doing relatively small campaigns every couple of days. So something like Emotet, which is not a ransomware, is consistent typically every single day, day in, day out, Monday through Friday, they do a campaign. These smaller ransomware runs, they're every couple of days, maybe every other week. And so what that typically says to me, especially with ransomware, using it as a first stage payload, is it might not be a full-on crimeware gang. It might be some individual or two people, or like we saw in the heyday of ransomware, two guys in a dorm room trying to pay off their student loans.
Yeah.
So we've seen in the past where a ransomware will come up and it'll disappear after 2 or 3 weeks because I assume they made enough money to buy a car.
So this isn't big game stuff that you're seeing. The big game stuff still belongs to those core crews. That's still their turf.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I looked at largest volume. Lockheed always wins, but Globe Imposter, GanCrab, all of those big first stage ransomware payloads that we saw in the past, they still win for top volume even today because a lot of the ransomware now is distributed by downloaders. It's a lot more effective to get ransomware on a ton of machines at once via downloader than to try and send them in first stage payloads via email.
Yeah. Because, I mean, you've got a better shot at bypassing controls via a downloader as well, I'd imagine, right?
Plus, you can launch all the ransomware at once across an entire company.
Woo!
Whereas if it's first stage, you have to wait for the email to come in, you have to wait for them to click, et cetera, et cetera. If you can get all those downloaders into a company at once, you can launch ransomware instantly all at the same time, which I think is all those big ransomware payments that we've seen, $1 million, $1.5 million. I think that's what they're doing. They're getting the downloaders across the entire company first and then they're hitting that ransomware button all at once.
And that's just to hit the ones that have the downloaders on them. So these aren't the people doing the hardcore lateral movement and, you know, take down the domain controller, push it out to everything. These are just like, try to hit, you know, 100 boxes at once and see what happens, see if they pay.
Yeah, exactly. Because a single machine with ransomware on it, I feel like IT teams have been great at putting together playbooks for incident response for a single machine with ransomware. Now, if you have 500 machines plus a bunch of servers with ransomware all at once, it's a lot harder to recover from that. So it's more likely they'll pay the ransom.
Well, there we go. Innovation in the crime world. Innovation. And of course, you know, this is ignoring all of the real low rent stuff, you know, automatic RDP brute forcing to drop some real cheap stuff, right? Like this is like mid-tier, you'd call it.
Yeah, or mid-tier or even really flexible groups that are saying, you know, we're going to try banking Trojans, then we're going to try some ransomware, then we're going to try an info stealer, a keylogger, kind of experimenting to see what works. We absolutely see testing and metrics being tracked and things like that to see what's most popular and what's most effective for that particular threat actor group.
They've all gone quite boring. They've got their KPIs, they got their metrics, right? Like they got
they're using
tickets.
Telemetry. There's definitely metrics. And I also think, much like corporate reality, they're also moving to the cloud. So it's like crimeware is following corporate enterprise trends, just like you would think.
Oh, man. It's crazy, though. At least these people will be prepared for the workforce if they decide to go legit, because they'll have run a DevSecOp team for their infrastructure. They'll have experience with code quality, deploying at scale, right? Like,
well, I really want to know if Fin7, they're using Jira, if they're following Agile too. Like if they have like morning stand up, if they're doing scrums, like who's the Fin7 scrum master? Like,
that's it.
Who is that?
Hello, if you're listening. Please
call
stop.
Me.
Please stop. Call Sherrod. There you go. Sherrod DiGrippo, thank you so much for joining us on the show to give us an update on some of the ransomware trends you were seeing over there at Proofpoint. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks, Patrick.
That was Sherrod DiGrippo there from Proofpoint. And remember, most badness these days, it still arrives by email. And Proofpoint is definitely the giant in the email security space. That is it for this week's show. I am still working on an edit of my interview with former Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. That's interesting stuff, and I'll publish that one when it's ready, but I really want to do a good job on that edit. I'm going to put in some annotations and stuff as well. So not quite sure when that one's going to be ready, but until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.